You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Western secret services remained pretty tight-lipped about their listening activities in West Berlin, and information about their espionage work on the Teufelsberg and the other spots can be obtained mostly from the open Stasi files, which is pretty ironic.
This is Cold War Conversations.
Thanks to Patreon Jim Black for our intro today. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. For almost half a century, the hottest front in the Cold War was right across Berlin. From summer 1945 until 1990, spying was part of everyday life in both East and West Berlin. I speak with historian Bernd von Koska of the Allied Museum in Berlin-Dahlem, who has co-authored with Sven Felix Kellerhoff the book Capital of Spies, Intelligence Agencies in Berlin During the Cold War, recently published by Casemate. The book describes the spectacular successes and failures of the various secret services based in the city, and in this episode we will concentrate on one of the chapters detailing the work of the various Allied listening stations, including the famous Teufelsberg. Now, you probably fast forward or you skip this bit, but the podcast does rely on your support to enable me to continue to capture these incredible stories and make them available for free. You can support my work and help to preserve Cold War history via one-off or monthly donations.
Hi, this is Tree from Berlin. I decided to support Cold War Conversations with a monthly subscription for a couple of reasons. I believe it's so important and interesting to hear these stories from that period, good and bad. Books will tell you so much, but the real-life stories from people who were there make it so real. Sometimes you feel like you are there experiencing these times in history.
If you're interested, please go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more details. So, back to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome Bernd von Koska to our Cold War conversation.
Teufelsberg is indeed a very remarkable place in Berlin, and it has so many historical layers that it's worth to looking at each one of them. And it starts in the mid-30s in the Third Reich, and it was the plan of Albert Speer, the general building inspector for the capital of the Reich, and he planned a university for Berlin. And the first building there should be the Faculty of Defense Technology of the Technical University. And Adolf Hitler himself performed the first hammer blow when the foundation stone was laid on the 27th of November in 1937. But the construction plans were revised, well, several times over the course and during the coming years, and that means that by the outbreak of World War II, only the main building of the faculty was nearly completed. So with no more buildings being constructed there during the war, the incomplete main building was about 50 meters in height, was the only remaining building there and was one of the ruins in Berlin in 1945. And then the second layer of history started, and that was when Berlin was looking for a spot or a place where they could put all the rubble of Berlin. You know, after the mass destruction in the Berlin, you have millions of tons of, and they decided to put it there near the Teufelssee, and approximately 12 million cubic meters, so thousands and thousands of lorry with this rubble. And they built the Teufelsberg. And basically, it was not the natural hill, but the complete 115-meter high Teufelsberg was completely made of this Second World War rubble.
I think it remains the highest point in Berlin still today.
It is, together with another little mountain that is called Mügelberg. They both have about 115 meters. And indeed, the Teufelsberg, because of this, became a popular recreational area, especially for the winter sports enthusiasts. So they did some skiing there, and it became a very popular place to go.
But the Americans and the British are not so interested in skiing, but see it as a really good opportunity to listen in on radio communications.
That's right. And they discovered that this hill has offered them the chance to install their equipment on the top. And indeed, for more than 20 years, the station on Teufelsberg was a clearly visible symbol of the technological side of the Cold War.
Yes, and still a visible symbol now, but we'll come on to that towards the end of our chat. How does the listening station develop?
Well, as you mentioned, the secret services in West Berlin became interested in that place, and it was in the British sector of Berlin. So the British were the first who set up mobile equipment and mobile listening stations up there. But between 1961 and 1963, the Americans negotiated with the British that they could use, the Americans, this place. And the Americans then were given control of the Teufelsberg, while the British armed forces were also allowed to make use of the site. And well, the Americans first put up their equipment as the British mobile equipment, but in between 1969 and 1971, the Americans built a permanent complex of buildings, and from 1972, they started listening around the clock. So in the same year, the British also moved their 26th signal unit from Gatow to the Teufelsberg. And they also installed a 120-meter-high antenna that was built by the German well-known company Rohde & Schwarz. And for 20 years, American and British secret services used this building complex of their telecommunication reconnaissance. And in addition to this well-known facility, there were a number of other spots in the western part of Berlin that were used for the same way, or at least for a similar purpose. And this is because of the unique geographical location of the city that made it an ideal place for the radio electronic reconnaissance efforts of the West.
What were they listening to, and what techniques did they use to capture information?
Western secret services remained pretty tight-lipped about their listening activities in West Berlin, and information about their espionage work on the Teufelsberg and the other spots can be obtained mostly from the open Stasi files, which is pretty ironic that you have to go to the former enemy to get more information on what the Western powers did here in Berlin. So East Germany and the Soviet Union were in the position to be able to gain extensive knowledge of the radio electronic reconnaissance a work of the Western powers there, and the role of spies in this regard will be discussed later.
You mentioned just a moment back that there were other listening stations in Berlin. What were those listening stations?
From an aerial point of view, Marienfelde and Teufelsberg, both in the American sector, look pretty similar. So the American forces in Berlin were based on Aschberg in the district of Marienfelde, also in the western part of the city in their sector. And this location was only 1,000 meters away from the East German border, from East Berlin. And the base there had been established in 1962. And in the coming years, altogether about 14 buildings were there, and 6 of them were used for monitoring communications. 6,912 electronic security group was stationed there at Marienfelde, and its task was to record and to evaluate all electromagnetic signals that refer to, in Anglo-American terminology, as signal intelligence or SIGINT. Obviously, there were other methods of acquiring intelligence. Communication intelligence, called COMINT, which monitored data transmissions from satellite to teleprinters, and also electronic intelligence, called ELINT, which dealt with the interception, recording, and deciphering of various signals and codes. And there at Marienfelde station, they were able to do all that kind of stuff, and in the frequency range from 25 megahertz to around 20 gigahertz, they were able to monitor all the signal traffic that came from the German Democratic Republic, from the Polish People's Republic, and from Czechoslovakia. So, like the Teufelsberg, Marienfelde was also in direct contact and in direct exchange with the National Security Agency headquarters in Fort Meade, United States, in Maryland. And the results of the work in Marienfelde, as well as on the Teufelsberg, were forwarded to the NSA pretty directly via computer-aided electronic data processing.
So that's Marienfelde. What were the other stations?
Well, Marienfelde and Teufelsberg were actually the two main listening stations. But nevertheless, there was also one in Tempelhof. The listening station Tempelhof stood on the ground of the airport there. And a modern radar installation was set up in the summer of 1984. Which enables the detection of other active radar installations within a radius of approximately 360 kilometers. So, according to the assessment of the Stasi, as I said, where you get the most information from, Marienfelde, Teufelsberg, and Tempelhof stations constituted an effective early warning system for the Americans, and aerial activities, any kind of aerial activities of the Warsaw Pact within a range of approximately 500 kilometers of those stations could be detected.
Wow. Wow. So these are really valuable installations for NATO.
That's right. And that's the reason why not only those listening stations were so important, but the city of Berlin was so important. Because it was right in the middle of former enemy land. And from here, you have much better opportunities for several things, especially for listening into those Warsaw Pact states.
Yeah. You mentioned Gatow in the British sector as well earlier.
Yes, indeed. I mentioned those three American listening stations, but also at the airport in Gatow. And in Gatow, they carried out radio electronic reconnaissance. And in the 50s, approximately 5,000 British conscripts were taught the Russian language, so they could listen to Russian radio traffic. And Gatow was definitely one of those locations where they were posted. And the most talented guys amongst those were given even the opportunity to study the language at the prestigious University of Cambridge. And in 1983, a new radar station was constructed in Gatow that enabled the detection of civil and military aircraft within a range, again, of several hundred kilometers. So,
you're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
The Americans had a kind of early warning system. The British had one as well. And now only one nation is left. It's the French.
Yeah. And the French often, I mean, they do sometimes get left out of the history of Berlin. But let's talk about the French. What do we know about their activities?
Well, again, unfortunately, little is known about the radio electronic reconnaissance of the French occupation forces in Berlin. And even the Stasi was unable to obtain any useful information in this regard, and probably did not even have any spy within the French secret area. So all that has been determinant about the military area in the effort in Tegel is what is that radio equipment that they have there and that was installed there for, well, unknown purpose. It's obvious that the security restrictions, especially for this area, was very high. Also, information about the nearby called Camp Foch, where the intelligence service of the French and armed forces were located, is also very limited. But one thing is for sure, even though all three Western powers were working together in Berlin, they did not work together in that field. The British and the Americans did, as I just mentioned, on the Teufelsberg. They shared this location. Not much was shared with the French.
I did interview a French soldier who worked in signals intelligence in Berlin, and he said that the security was quite lax, but he was operating at quite a low level in terms of just listening in and transcribing and sending data back to Paris.
There's one nice little episode when they sold all the furniture, the equipment of the Allied forces. They also sold tables and chairs from the French. And one guy noticed that on the table, a radio frequency in East Germany. So obviously a guy was sitting on that table who was listening to East German radio frequencies because he scratched it in the table.
Wow. Wow, that is a great story. So, just going back to the Teufelsberg. I mean, inevitably, with any soldiers, if they have trouble pronouncing something, they change the name. And I think the Americans had an abbreviation for the Teufelsberg, didn't they?
Yeah, it's easy to call it T-berg or the Hill. So whenever we talked about the Teufelsberg, it's to Americans or to British, you can always call it T-berg or the Hill, and they would know what you're talking about. But the military name for it was FSB, Field Station Berlin. So whenever you go into documents, you would find FSB, and that's Field Station Berlin. And in July 1961, the Special Operations Unit of the Americans 78th Army Security Agency, the ASA, set up the first mobile listening station on the hill, as Teufelsberg was colloquially referred to by the Americans. And from 1962, this unit became directly under the command of the headquarters of the ASA in the United States. And in 1967, the unit was renamed Field Station Berlin, SFB. And as a result of a reconstructing in 1977, the FSB, the Field Station Berlin on Teufelsberg, was integrated into the Intelligence and Security Command, INSCOM, of the U.S. Army. And also stationed on the hill on Teufelsberg was the 6,912th Electronic Security Group of the U.S. Air Force. And it was the NSA that determined the objectives to be archived and the tasks to be carried out on the Teufelsberg. There were physically at least two, sometimes more, people from the NSA directly on the Teufelsberg station to make sure that the important stuff went directly to Fort Meade, whereas all the other stuff that was recorded, was recorded and they listened to it later.
Right. And how many people were working there?
Well, the Teufelsberg was operating 365 days a week in a three-shift system, 24 hours a day. And because of this three-shift system, up to 1,500 people worked in the buildings of this listening station. And you can say approximately 1,000 of them were members of the U.S. Armed Forces, and another 300 to 500 were members of the British Army and the Royal Air Force. Imagine, it is a little town itself. They even had their own fitness center. I know that because I screwed the fitness center sign at the Teufelsberg, and it's now in the collection of the Allied Museum in Berlin.
What sort of technology were they using? Do we have any insight into that?
Again, well, when they moved out of Teufelsberg in 1992, obviously they took all the equipment and literally all of it with them. But you can be sure that at the time, the latest and most innovative technical equipment was used by the field station Berlin in order to fully exploit the mass of information that is being collected there. And all the Teufelsberg equipment was paid by the American taxpayer, which is pretty unusual in West Berlin because all the other stuff the military used, buses and whatever you need. That was paid by the German taxpayer. But the stuff they bought for the Teufelsberg is obviously so a secret that they didn't want any German eyes on that equipment. So they paid it themselves. And in the event that Berlin should be seized by the enemy, it is obviously necessary to first place to destroy all the documents, and second place to destroy all the equipment, because you don't want this equipment in the hands of the enemy, neither the documents you produced. So therefore, they conducted several times each year, they conducted a little exercise where they dealt with the destruction of material and also of electronic devices. And in one case, such exercise went terribly wrong. And in Marienfelde in 1986, a document shredder exploded and injured 34 Americans.
Do we know of what intelligence gains NATO got as a result of their listening post on the T-Berg?
Well, it's, again, difficult to say much about the quality of the information obtained on the Teufelsberg, as there are insufficient sources of this matter. But it can only be speculated whether there were any important messages and deceptions amongst that stuff, especially during the Cold War. But nevertheless, I cannot give you a single example, but in general, I can say there's one indication of the effectiveness of Teufelsberg, and that is that the U.S. Department of Defense has awarded the prestigious, they called it Travis Trophy, every year since 1964, to the unit that has made the most important contribution to strategical reconnaissance. And all intelligence units in the Army, in the Navy, and in the Air Force all around the world are considered. And the field station in Berlin on the Teufelsberg is the only unit that has received this trophy four times, in 1973, 1981, 1985, and 1989. So I would say this is a strong hint that the Teufelsberg was also pretty effective.
Indeed. Indeed. So this must have been one of the top NATO installations that the Soviets and the East Germans wanted to gain intelligence about. What did the Soviets and the East Germans know about the installation?
Well, obviously, as you said, the East German regime was very interested in finding out more about the efficiency and the function of the Teufelsberg station. And they generally did so on the one hand by analyzing what is obvious, what can be seen, the equipment especially, and also by trying to find any people who give them any kind of information. So they were actually trying to get spies into those areas like Teufelsberg and Gattau. The East Germans even had their own program for it, and they call it Relais. That was a code name for helicopter flights over West Berlin, whose purpose was to observe the antenna sets that were set up by the Western powers in those stations like Teufelsberg, Marienfelde, Tempelhof, Gattau. And those helicopter flights were, of course, totally legal. Not illegal, but they were legal. And they even had own division of the Stasi that undertook these reconnaissance flights. And for example, in 1986, a Soviet Mi-17 transport helicopter took 84 hours in the air exclusively on that task. So for 84 hours, he was doing nothing else but photographing, filming, and having a good look at all the antennas on those listening stations. And what do the Western powers do to protect their equipment? And that's pretty simple. They were trying, obviously, to hide their equipment. And at the Teufelsberg and at Marienfelde, they were doing that under so-called randoms, which looks like oversized golf balls. And this is still today. You can see those golf balls from kilometers far away from the Teufelsberg. For wherever you are and you look at the Teufelsberg, you will see those golf balls.
Yeah, they're pretty wrecked now, but they're still very distinctive. So the Soviets and the East Germans are looking at these sites visually from helicopters and from across the border, but did they manage to get any agents in place at Field Station Berlin?
At Field Station Berlin, yes, they were able to do that, and they were also able to do that in Gattau. And finally, they were able to do that in Marienfelde. So I just mentioned the most important listening stations, Teufelsberg, Gattau, Marienfelde. And in all three of them, the Stasi and the KGB had their spies.
So who was the Gattau spy?
Well, the Gattau spy is a guy called Geoffrey Prime. And he is a British wireless operator and has a good knowledge of the Russian language. And therefore, he was posted at the Royal Air Force in Gattau in 1964. And he worked there in the signals intelligence. He decided to work for the other side to earn some money. But the way he made contact to the Russian side was quite interesting. He was going to West Berlin by the duty train that run regularly from West Germany to West Berlin, transporting soldiers and also their families. And the duty train stopped at the train station in checkpoint Marienborn. And the soldiers were not allowed to open the window, but Geoffrey Prime did that. When the train moved on, he opened the window and threw out a piece of paper on the platform. And on the paper it says what his name, what he's doing, and that he's willing to work for money to get information from Gatto for money. And that also shows you how simple it was to make contact with the other side. Ironically, even though if someone of his colleagues would have seen him throwing something out of the window, he could always say, well, it's trash, and I wanted to leave my trash in East Berlin, and that would be funny, and everything, everybody would laugh. So, and he was totally safe because the train wouldn't stop. So none of the soldiers or whatever were allowed to get out on checkpoint Marienborn on the platform. Just the officer who was negotiating the train details. And after the officer is on the train again, that's it. And it was really simple for him to make contact. And indeed, he was equipped with a small Minox camera, and he was trained in various techniques for passing on intelligence. And he was stationed in Gatto for 4 years. And during that time, he was especially handing information over to the Soviet side. And when he was transferred to England, he also worked in various positions at the GCHQ. And he remained a double agent during this time until 1977. He photographed countless documents for the Soviets, and his last exchange of documents was in Vienna in 1980. And then he retired.
So how was he caught then?
Again, a strange story. He was caught because he was sexual assaulting a minor. And for that reason, the police arrested him, and then they checked his house. But what they found was proof that he was working for the KGB. And then he was sentenced to 38 years prison, and he received, I think, 35 years for being a spy and 3 years for the sexual assault of a minor.
Who was the spy directly in the Teufelsberg?
Oh, that is a guy called James W. Hall. And he, like the British guy, decided to offer his service to the Soviet Union. And again, the way he could do it is typical Berlin. He just wrote down his willingness to cooperate in a letter, and then he dropped the letter in the mailbox of the Soviet consulate in East Berlin. As simple as that. And the KGB was naturally interested in working with this 25-year-old sergeant who was working on the Teufelsberg at the time. And he was the first infiltration of this facility. And ironically, it was not only the KGB who was able to persuade this spy, James W. Hall, but also the Stasi approached him via another guy. So Hall was basically working for both KGB and the Stasi for a couple of years. And I think only after 2 years, the KGB found out that he was also handing over the documents to the Stasi, And then they ask him to decide only to work for one of the agencies. And Ho decided to quit with the KGB and to continue with the Stasi. But that's later in the history. I'd like to mention the guy who was able to recruit Ho for the Stasi. And that is a very, very interesting and somehow also a strange character. And that is a Turkish guy called Hüseyin Yildirim. He was, I would say...
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia. And I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
An average Berliner in the 70s, a lot of Turkish foreign workers here in West Berlin. And he was obsessed by the idea of being a spy. So he visited East Berlin several times, contacted the Stasi, and said he would like to do business with the Stasi. But, you know, the Stasi could actually do nothing with this guy. He had no connections. He has no important job. He knows nobody. So they sent him home and said, well, come back if you either have an interesting job with the Allied forces. So I think they thought they would never see him again. The opposite was the case. Yisim Hilderim managed to get a job as a master mechanic at the U.S. Army Vehicle Repair Shop in West Berlin. That's a place where soldiers on their own could try to repair their cars and under professional guidance. And this guy, Yisim Hilderim, was a master mechanic, and therefore he had a lot of contacts with soldiers and also with the ones who worked at the Teufelsberg. And only a couple of months after James Hall decided to work for the KGB, those two guys met, the Turkish master mechanic at the repair shop and James Hall in the repair shop bringing his car. They started to chat. They talked about financial situations and stuff like this. And Hall was open for that kind of work anyway. And so it was pretty easy for Yildirim to persuade Hall to work for the Stasi. So that's the reason why it came that James Hall worked for both the KGB and the Stasi.
Did US counterintelligence not pick up on, you know, the fact that he was perhaps had more money than he would have been earning in the army or anything like that?
Well, there's a looking at it nowadays, I would even call it a funny story with the Turk Yildirim. So Yildirim had a German girlfriend, a new German girlfriend. And the former lover of his new German girlfriend went to the U.S. forces, to the U.S. Army, to the counterintelligence and said, this Turkish guy is a Stasi spy. So they invited Yildirim for an interview and confronted him with the fact that the guy said that he is a Stasi spy. And Yildirim managed to talk him out of the situation. He said, well, no, he's only jealous because I'm the new lover of his former girlfriend and oh no. And obviously he had the nature to convince people. And strange enough, because of this interview, the Berlin counterintelligence found him not guilty, though found no evidence. And in fact, weeks later and months later, Yildirim was more than once the private guest of the chief of the Berlin counterintelligence. And he was sitting in the living room with the chief of the Berlin counterintelligence and drinking some alcoholic drinks and chatting about everyday life. So that's so crazy. So they had him, yeah. They had him in front of the desk, and someone accused him to be a spy for the Stasi. But well, they couldn't find evidence. He was talking himself out of the situation, and he got away with it.
That would have been very embarrassing when that was brought up with the head of counterintelligence in Berlin. What sort of intelligence was Hall passing over? Because he was transferred at one point as well from the Teufelsberg.
Yeah, from the Teufelsberg, Hall worked there for a couple of years, and then he was transferred back to the United States, and then he applied again for a job in Frankfurt. One could say he might even did more damage during his job in Frankfurt than he did on the Teufelsberg. But during the whole time, Yildirim was at his side, and Yildirim was handling all the stuff he was able to get out. Yildirim brought that to East Berlin, negotiated a price for the documents, and then they both shared the money they received from the Stasi. And what kind of secrets Hall told the KGB? He, as I said, he was posted to Frankfurt, to the 25th Military Intelligence Battalion there, and the U.S. 5th Corps in Frankfurt. And all together, he approximately copied 10,000 documents, amongst which were top secret plans developed by NATO.
Wow. And I think Marcus Wolf was a big fan of the pair as well.
Well, it was his dream team. You know, looking at those two guys, the handler, the Turkish handler of the documents, the one who's negotiating the price, and James Hall, who was first on the Teufelsberg, later on in Frankfurt, in very interesting positions and very important positions. And obviously, as a spy master for East Germany, you must have been a fan of those two guys.
Yeah. How were they exposed in the end?
They were exposed because there was an East German agent, Manfred Severin, who went to the West, to the United States in 1987, and he told them about Yildirim and Hall. And so they built a trap in the United States, and they brought those two guys together again in the United States so they could both arrest them in the States. And they handed over documents, and they offered money, and it was all on camera. And yes, in December 1988, the American counterespionage section was able to get those two in the United States and arrest them there.
And are they both still in prison?
Obviously, their sentence was pretty high, but both of them were freed now. Hall was sentenced to 40 years in prison, and Yildirim, who did not confess, was even sentenced to a lifetime imprisonment in 1989. But the circumstances were such that in 1989, Yildirim could hope for a spy exchange. You know, he was a Stasi spy. You know, all those spy exchanges, for example, on Glienicke Bridge. So being a spy imprisoned in the United States in May 1989, you could still hope that the Stasi would get you out. But unfortunately, German unification came at the end of the year, and finally in 1990. And then Yildirim was trapped. He stuck in the prison in the United States. And but after, let's after I think 15 years in American prison, he was set free. And he made a stopover while he was going to Turkey. He made a stopover in Germany, and he was at the Allied Museum. And there, for the very first time in person, the spymaster Markus Wolf and his Turkish spy on the Teufelsberg, the handler, met in person at the Allied Museum. And there's a photo of this meeting at the museum and in the book as well.
That's incredible. Was Hall the only agent that the Soviets and the East Germans managed to get onto the Teufelsberg, or were there any others?
He was the only one, but the Americans took steps to prevent similar spies, because when Hall was interviewed after it was known he was a spy and was arrested, he said that he would never have worked for the KGB or the Stasi if he had undergone polygraph tests while he was doing his work on the Teufelsberg or in Frankfurt. And this sentence, it ring a bell with the guys who were running those installations. And from then on, at the field station, the soldiers who were handling sensitive data were subjected to a lie detector. And that was not done before Hall, but after him. The KGB and the Stasi had on all three installations, they had spies. We talked about Hall and Yildirim on the Teufelsberg. We talked about Jeffrey Byam and Gatto. And now there's still one guy missing who was working in Marienfelde at the listening station. And this is a young guy called Jeffrey Carney, who at a very early age, at 17, decided to enter the U.S. Air Force services, and he had incredible good skills in German. So Carney was a very complex character, and his story is so amazing. And in his autobiography, which has more than 500 pages, he is mentioning that all. But to make a long story short, he was working for a long time for the Stasi. His personal wish was always to live in East Berlin as an average and normal citizen. The Stasi knew that, but they had him on the hook, and he worked for the Stasi for many, many years until German unification came. After unification, he became an average citizen, a normal GDR citizen. He was a U-Bahn, a metro driver in East Berlin. And incredibly enough, after it was obvious that this German guy, who had a different name then, was actually a former U.S. soldier and spy for the Stasi, the CIA just kidnapped him in unified Germany without telling the German government, and Carney was sentenced again to be a spy in the United States, stayed there for many, many, many years in prison, and then was released and very unhappy that he lost his German documents and is no longer a German citizen and is not allowed to come back. And as I said, it's a very, very interesting story, but a very long one. But I just want to mention there was another spy for the Stasi. That was the American Jeffrey Carney in Marienfelde.
Yeah, and we'll probably dedicate an episode to Jeffrey Carney, because it is a really interesting story. So stand by for that. So what happens to the Teufelsburg after the opening of the war?
Americans and the British moved out of the field station Berlin in 1992. They took all their equipment with them, of course. And then only 2 years later, there was an investor who bought that place and who was hoping to build a hotel and a housing area on the top of the hill. But this plans didn't came into reality. So this investor consortium and group still owns that place, and they couldn't agree with the city government how to develop this place. And in between, the American film director David Lynch had the plan that he wanted to build an esoteric university on top of the hill over there. But that all didn't happen. And what happened in 2011 was they opened the place again and offered guided tours. And nowadays it's a kind of an open-air gallery for graffiti artists. So I've just been up there a month ago with a guest from the United States, a lady from the Spy Museum in Washington. She wanted to see the place. And you have marvelous graffiti up there, and you still have an incredible view from the rooftop of the Teufelsberg. As I said, the golf balls are half destroyed, but you still know what they were for. And it's still a very, very interesting place to visit. But it's under construction preservation, and any plans to build a spy museum up there or to have, again, offices or restaurants or whatever, this is very questionable, and we will see what will happen to this place.
Now, the name of Bernd's book is Capital of Spies, Intelligence Agencies in Berlin During the Cold War. There are links in the show notes for you to purchase from, and that will help support Cold War Conversations. Now, this show wouldn't exist without our generous Patreons, so I want to thank one and all of them for their support. You can very easily become a Patreon by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And you can also join our Facebook group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.